I'm here on the job site with Dale, who's a framing contractor.
Hey, good morning.
Dale traded up to Geico Commercial Auto Insurance for all his business vehicles. We're here where he needs us most.
Yep, they sure are.
We make it easy for him to save on all his insurance needs, all in one place, with coverage that fits his business and bottom line. Oh, I shouldn't have looked down.
It's all right.
We're so far up here.
Look at me. Take a deep breath.
Oh, I'm good. So good.
Get a commercial auto insurance quote today at geico.com and see how much you could save. Get more with Geico.
Welcome to Fossils and Fiction, the podcast where we explore the culture and science of paleontology. I'm media researcher and dino geek Travis Holland.
And I'm paleontologist and weird bug enthusiast Alyssa Field. Each episode, we uncover the incredible stories behind fossils and meet the people who study them, create art inspired by them, and bring prehistory to life.
Welcome to this episode of Fossils and Fiction. It's been a little while. We've been struck down with illness yet again. That one's on me. Last time it was Alyssa, but this time it's on me. But we're back and we are talking in front of the microphones. So, hi.
Hello, everyone. Hope you've been well and enjoying, if you're in Australia, the start to our winter. It's a ridiculously sunny day over here in Melbourne, Australia. It looks like, Travis, you've got some nice weather up in New South Wales.
We have had a polar blast. We had snow this week for the first time this year. And I'm not in an area that snows. It sort of gets snow once or twice a year, but not very heavy. But this year, it suddenly hit us.
The crew that is not currently on fieldwork at UNE was experiencing snow and were posting videos of themselves standing outside with unnatural expressions going, this just doesn't seem quite right, does it?
Meanwhile, another of our friends is on fieldwork up in the Pilbara at the moment in Western Australia, and the weather seems to be absolutely perfect up there. And in fact, that is Adele Pentland. So if you know Adele and if you follow her on Instagram, we're going to talk about a paper that she was involved in writing. Just to be clear, it was lead authored by Stephen Poropat, but there were a lot of other authors on there, including Adele Pentland. And this paper is so exciting. It offers the first ever evidence of sauropod gut contents, first anywhere in the world from Queensland. Amazing.
It's insane how well preserved this particular example of sauropod is. And some of the other authors on this paper include Sam Beeston, who you guys may recognize from Adele's own podcast, Pals in Paleo. Adele Pentland is an absolute rock star if you've listened to our other episodes that feature her. But of course, this project required quite a few people to reach the point of success that it did. So there were quite a few volunteers that work with the Australian Age of Dinosaurs Museum of Natural History that helped prep this fossil, which is named Judy. In particular, Hugh Calvey and Kim Partridge were two of the gentlemen that were most involved in getting this beautiful animal out of the hot Queensland desert and preparing it so that we could get the fantastic scientific evidence that we have in this article.
Yeah, that's right. So the article is called Fossilized Gut Contents Elucidate the Feeding Habits of Sauropod Dinosaurs. It was published in Current Biology. As I mentioned, it's the first sauropod gut contents found anywhere in the world in that specimen of Diamantinosaurus named Judy. And it's named Judy after one of the founders of the Australian Age of Dinosaurs Museum. Because, of course, that family has been hugely involved in this new sort of industry for Western Queensland. So the fossil was unearthed in 2016. They used the Australian synchrotron to scan a section of rock found inside the dinosaur's belly area and inside some preserved skin. So based on the location, they kind of went, this looks like gut contents, which is pretty exciting. And what was found inside it was mineralized plants that were, when they were mineralized, in various stages of decomposition. And so they determined that rather than having been chewed, these plant parts were swallowed whole, or mostly whole, and then they were digested in the gut. So it actually says to us that sauropods, they didn't chew very much, or at least this group of sauropods didn't. They swallowed the plants and let them digest.
The other interesting finding, I think, here was that the sauropods were engaging in what's called multi-level browsing, which means that they weren't strictly limited to one part of the canopy, which, when you look at the Blinder reconstructions by Astrid O'Connor, is quite interesting because the long, I don't remember the technical term that is used for it, but the bony protrusions from the neck vertebrae are, like in a lot of sauropods, there are these bony protrusions that interlock down the bottom of the neck that would have made it very difficult for the sauropod to raise and lower its neck in the way that you would think they would do to engage in multi-level browsing. So there, I assume that means that these animals were probably rearing onto their back legs or something like that mechanically in order to engage in that kind of feeding.
There's a diagram both in the article in the journal that it's been published in, as well as in the conversation, which shows the difference between this group of sauropods and some others, and mm-hmm. when they have those longer extensions on the vertebra. My understanding is that the longer extensions on the vertebra mean that the sauropods probably were maintaining a raised feeding height, yeah. or they couldn't move their necks very much in either case. But the ones like this one that had those slightly shorter ones could probably move up and down. It may have also been about age. So they were talking about age, that this particular specimen is a subadult. And so it may be the case that they have different feeding strategies as they age as well. But yeah, in the case of Judy, it showed that her last meal, or its last meal, we shouldn't assume that it was a female dinosaur just because of the nickname. Judy's last meal was conifers, which are the relatives of those modern redwoods, so likely up in the tree canopy, as well as seed pods from extinct ferns at that mid-level, and then leaves from angiosperms or flowering plants. So all of that was consumed in the hours before she died, or before Judy died. And yeah, as you say, it shows us that they browsed at varying heights, but maybe that changed as they aged. So in terms of the overall paleoecology of the Winton area, so this is Winton in Queensland, the paper mentions that, and I'm quoting here, given the Winton formation records the transition in Australian floras from conifer and seed fern dominance to their co-dominance with angiosperms, so that is the rise of angiosperms in the later Cretaceous, it is unsurprising that Diamantinosaurus exploited all three groups. And so that's the summary, that these were generalist browsers at all levels and on whatever they could get their mouths around. So yeah, really exciting findings on sauropods.
And if you guys are interested in the kinds of fossils that preserve dinosaur diets, the ones found inside the dinosaur are called coelolites, but the ones found outside the dinosaurs will become important in a future episode.
Just a little hint for what's coming up later on. But let's jump into the very exciting. Alyssa, you got to have a sit down with someone who I think many of us very much admire. I certainly do. This is a paleontologist who is more well known for their paleo art. Please introduce our special guest.
As many people in the paleontology community may know, our guest today is someone whose artwork has been featured heavily both in museum exhibits, publications, and in the online art space as hyper-realistic, or at least incredibly realistic, depictions of particularly pterosaurs, but often other dinosaurs as well. One of their most recent pictures actually depicts an ankylosaur fight happening. But their recent publication that we're going to highlight throughout this interview, King Tyrant, is dedicated to the paleontological history of and new findings for the animal Tyrannosaurus rex. This author and artist, of course, is Mark Witten, one of our most beloved figures in paleo art. Dr. Mark Witten began his career with pterosaurs and moved into a wider group of animals that include dinosaurs and all sorts of other prehistoric fauna. Mark's also been a consultant for numerous paleontological and prehistoric television shows, including Prehistoric Planet. And if you're interested in more of Mark's work, he's published an incredible array of books. So let's hear what he has to say about King Tyrant and a variety of other things in the paleontological world. We're here today talking with Mark Witten, PhD, who you may know from his art you see regularly around the internet in different places. Mark is an incredible realistic paleo artist who's studied animals ranging from pterosaurs to his most recent publication, King Tyrant, going through the natural history of Tyrannosaurus rex, theories, and all sorts of different lovely depictions of this animal. Mark, you have an extensive history in the paleontology community. You've been hanging around at least since, gosh, when would your earliest piece of paleo art have been?
2006 was the first time anything was published. I suppose it was around then, sort of mid 2000s, like sort of 2005, 2006. I started putting things online.
Gosh, it's been two decades of your art. That must be an incredible journey for you to have followed. Just kind of growing up, was paleo art something that you were interested in as a kid, or is that something that you got into later in life?
Yeah, so I've always drawn things, and I've always been interested in prehistoric animals and particularly dinosaurs. I've always been drawing things, but I assumed my career would be more in towards sort of the academic end of paleontology, hence, why I PhD'd and this sort of thing. And now I find that I don't really fit into any one camp. So I do artwork, I write books, I write papers. And somewhere in all of this, I managed to keep a roof over my head. So it's a bit of a strange career that I have. And it's an unusual career trajectory that I've been on. But it's a fun way to make a living because every day is different. So one day I'm writing something. The next day I'm painting something. The next day I'm consulting for a documentary or something. So every day is a little bit different. Yeah, it can. So what I do is as a freelancer, and any sort of freelance work can be, you know, a bit fraught. It can be a bit, you know, sometimes you're thinking, gosh, there's not been a project coming for a little while, and you sort of hope everything will work out. And things generally have done, but it's taken a while to get to this point where you can sort of reliably make an income off this. But it's a strange little career that I've had so far, and I hope it continues for another 20 years or so.
I definitely agree. It's paleontology is already kind of a niche market. Departments never know whether we're geology or biology, and you bounce between the two kind of at random, seemingly, depending on the institution. And my understanding from the different paleo artists that are in our lab group is that it can be a long journey, in part because the art takes quite a long time to create if you're someone who's quite interested in creating realistic depictions. Do you find that there's any one component of the creation process that you enjoy the most, or any component that you enjoy the least?
I mean, it's you know, this is a bit of a cliche to say, but it's all fun and interesting. I do especially like doing the research side of things. It's amazing that you can go to very well-trodden paleoartistic ground and there's still interesting things to find there that people haven't really touched. And sometimes you find things about the anatomy that people have overlooked, or there'll be something suggested about the behavior of an extinct animal that no one's looked at. And that's something that I'm always keen to explore in my artwork. You might remember a few years ago that there was a lot of push for lots of speculation in artwork and to show animals doing new things that we've never seen evidenced in the fossil record. And while I think that's valid, what I found over the years is that there's so many things that we haven't even got to yet. And we kind of, it's not that we don't need to speculate, but that there's an extremely rich picking still to be had from our research and our data that we have on fossil animals. And that's what I think is really fun, is you draw something and you say, this isn't just me waving my arms around and going, oh, what if they did this? This is going, this is what our fossils suggest they could do. And so that's a fun thing to bring into artwork. Obviously, then you have to actually execute the painting itself. And that's a whole other story of trying to work out nice compositions, decide what your animal's going to look like. And of course, nowadays we have an extra challenge that in some cases we know what some of these animals look like in a lot of detail. So, you know, we're talking about some feathered dinosaurs where we know exactly how many feathers they have on in their wings and things. So you have to balance knowing what we do know with the more creative aspects of it, and then tie it all together in a way which looks sort of nice and shows the sort of scene that you want. So it's a process that has fun points at every step of the way.
Would there be some good examples of this in your latest publication? I'm just thinking, you know, we have this extensive, I don't want to say fan community, but Tyrannosaurus Rex certainly has a lot of attention, and it has done since its discovery. And you talk about the 150-year history of this animal and the ways that it's been depicted over time with, I think it was 150 illustrations in your new book. I'm assuming there's some really interesting new anatomical information that you've kind of represented in some of these illustrations. Any that you want to point out in particular?
So yeah, I think with Tyrannosaurus is a fascinating animal because, as you say, it's been drawn to death. You know, it is something that if you do a Google image search for Tyrannosaurus, it is just this infinite scroll. Who knows how many pictures of that animal exist? It's an incalculable number. And yet you can still find new things to do with it. And this is, I think a lot of this comes from trying to appreciate Tyrannosaurus as a complete animal rather than imagining it as the version that we all know from the stereotype portrayals of it, from films and documentaries, where all we ever see of Tyrannosaurus is it as a big adult eating other dinosaurs. That's basically what it does. Tyrannosaurus as a juvenile looked completely different to what the big adults looks like. You know, as a juvenile, it's maybe about a meter long. It's got incredibly long legs. It's got longer arms. It's got a shallower face. It's a completely different looking animal, but that is just as much a valid picture of Tyrannosaurus as, you know, a big 8-ton, 12-meter long thing with giant jaws. And of course you have every gross age in between. So that in itself is something something not necessarily completely new to bring to the table, but it's certainly a lot fresher to say, hey, look, here's my picture of a fox-sized baby Tyrannosaurus. And then you've got all the behavioral aspects of, well, there's things like, you know, there's behaviors for Tyrannosaurus that we have really good evidence for. So things like face biting. There's listeners maybe familiar with the idea of that theropods grappled one another by biting their jaws, as do lots of living animals. It seems to be something that they do when they get to the sort of second phase of their life, or either sexually mature phase, which coincides with what we see in living animals, where face biting begins once animals get old enough to start worrying about, you know, things like territories and mating, this kind of thing. So we think that the same thing is happening for theropods. And we have extensive evidence for this in Tyrannosaurus. We have literally hundreds and hundreds of bite marks over their skulls. And we even know, in some cases, the sort of orientation of their bodies when they're engaging in face biting. We can say they're probably lining their bodies up side to side and swiping at one another with their faces. That's the kind of thing that you can, that's excellent inspiration.
Corporate megastores are spending millions lobbying DC politicians on one-sided policies that send small businesses tumbling. They want to enact harmful credit card mandates that take resources away from your local credit union and community bank, leaving Main Street businesses with less access to credit, making it harder for your family to pay for everyday goods like gas and groceries. Tell Congress to guard your card and oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card mandates.
Paid for by Electronic Payments Coalition.
For drawing, because you can take all of that and say, I'm going to draw that specific thing. But again, it's amazing just how little you see images of that specific behavior, because people are more interested in showing a Hollywoodized version of Tyrannosaurus, where it's doing things that look cool in terms of a cinematic composition, rather than actually just doing what it did as an animal. And I'll give one more example, which I think is my personal favorite. A few years ago now, there was a conference abstract about how Tyrannosaurus would access the neck muscles of Triceratops by detaching the head from the body. And so to my mind, that would just be, you know, telling all the paleo artists, like, right, go. We know that T-Rex was pulling the head off Triceratops. Go do it. How many people have drawn that? Virtually no one. And it's like, it's Tyrannosaurus pulling the head off Triceratops. Do we need to draw you a map? Come on, guys, let's get to it. So I was amazed that no one had really done that. But it's nice for me, because it means I can draw that and I can show it to people and go, look, fossils say that this was happening. So it's, even for T-Rex, there's still lots of new areas to go to. And we could list examples all day of all the neat things you can draw about T-Rex that are being neglected in typical artwork.
Yeah. I mean, I think it makes sense that we would see really different ontogenetic sequences for these massive predators, because I mean, to some extent, that's what we see with like some modern carnivores. I mean, for the listeners at home, I want you to picture what like a baby, you know, large cat looks like with its massive feet. And, you know, there are a lot of modern animals that we know of today that would have vastly different small forms compared to their adult forms. So I think it's actually really interesting to think about, you know, these animals that we would see, as you say, on traditional publications, or not traditional publications, but traditional mass media, as just being like smaller versions of their large, fierce mothers and fathers, the kind of Jurassic World depiction. And it's really interesting that there's all of this fossil evidence for behavior that just hasn't been looked at before. And my understanding is that something that's getting investigated more and more frequently, just kind of across paleontology. But I know that, so I've got a colleague named Adele Pentland who looks at pterosaurs and has been looking at new pterosaurs discovered in Australia. And it always amazes me how much detail we have for these animals and their behavior as well.
Oh, sure. Yeah. I mean, it's something that, you know, exactly that same process of wanting to find the interesting things that science say about these animals, that remain, yeah, that's always kind of been my approach. And I think that might stem from coming into artwork, not exactly accidentally, because as I said, I've always done artwork of things, training up to be a scientist, and then finding when I finished my PhD that actually, you know, I was being employed more as an artist. The two things kind of then came together. And so you had, on the one hand, a keen interest in researching things and wanting to find kind of everything I could before I started drawing anything. And then you know, obviously you've got the capacity to try and illustrate some of those ideas. And so the two things came together, and it's always been my approach. And the thing to emphasize is that when I first started drawing pterosaurs, and they're what I became known for drawing initially, this was a point where you just weren't seeing many pictures of the just the diversity of pterosaurs with their accurate proportions and with their, you know, amazing head crests and things. The mid-2000s was kind of the tail end of a a real kind of, what's the word I'm looking for here? Not exactly a revolution in our understanding of pterosaurs, but between the 90s and 2000s, our understanding of pterosaurs advanced considerably, in many cases through the discovery of new fossil sites that showed what pterosaurs were really like, and then started to put a lot of the scrappy fossils of pterosaurs we had from elsewhere in the world, we could now start to put those in context because we had complete skeletons and we had an idea of what the animals actually looked like. So there was real scope back in the mid-2000s to be drawing pterosaurs, and you could impress people quite a lot by just going, hey, this is what this thing actually looked like. Now we're still learning a lot of new things about pterosaurs, but we've had that initial breakthrough period, and so yeah, that you can maybe start to focus on things like their behavior a lot more than you used to.
Right. I mean, it's an animal with very strange proportions as well. It's as if you keep selecting for the large-headed, strange-armed fellows of the distant past. But that's certainly interesting to hear. And it's interesting as well to hear that, I guess, pterosaur research was maybe a couple of steps behind dinosaur research, in the sense that, you know, in the 90s, you had dinosaur heresies and you had Jurassic Park and all of these other breakthrough pieces of media. Do you feel that, I suppose, traditional dinosaur research kind of does that in general, kind of taking a little bit of a lead ahead of things like pterosaur research or, I guess, dinosaur and friends sort of category of animals?
Yeah, I mean, dinosaur research certainly does now. In the history of paleontology, you know, dinosaurs weren't always at the forefront of the research. But certainly since the 1970s, dinosaurs have been on a big upswing. And now, of course, they're this sort of cultural and scientific behemoth, you know, that they are the stars of paleontology. And so, yeah, and anything really fun and exciting, any sort of new methodology is probably going to be applied to a dinosaur before it is to anything else. And so that means that everything else does play catch up, you know, and pterosaurs are probably a few steps behind dinosaurs because they're also a very popular group. But the number of people who work on dinosaurs around the world, and I don't have numbers for you, but I think the number of people working on dinosaurs vastly outstrips the number of people who work on pterosaurs. Mm-hmm. And then within that, the number of people who work on pterosaurs as a speciality, you know, the kind of people who really know every specimen, who can remember every single publication, you know, there's probably only a handful of people around the world who can do that. And that is something that may be surprising to listeners, is that actually the expertise for some of these vast fossil groups is often restricted to relatively small communities. You know, we often joke, if you go to a conference and it's like, well, if something really bad happened here, you know, there was a fire in this building, then suddenly the world's expertise in pterosaurs would just reduce to nothing. For dinosaurs, that there's lots and lots of people. Not to say that there's, you know, not a relatively small band of experts even for that. But for pterosaurs and similar groups, is surprisingly small, you know, the community that does all the research on them.
I would definitely say that that's true for the invertebrate community as well. I believe our famous joke is that quote from Arrested Development, there are dozens of us, dozens. But I think, generally speaking, that's an interesting point. And yes, to the listeners out there, we have a handful of quite famous science and paleontology communicators within our community. But the expert base for a lot of these topics, especially topics like paleobotany, is incredibly restricted. Paleobotany in particular has become more restricted with time. But I wanted to ask a little bit about your involvement as a consultant for different paleo projects. Are you typically brought on more as an artist or as an expert on these more obscure groups, or just as a general consultant for the balance of science and communication?
So a bit of column A, a bit of column B. In recent years, I found myself doing design work for documentaries. So things like, I can't tell you everything that I've done because I've signed some NDAs, but yeah, things like Prehistoric Planet, I designed a number of species for that. And that was a really cool project to work on because it was so big and so expansive. And the secret to making these wonderful documentaries is not only having a really good, knowledgeable crew base, but it's also having the money to turn all of that knowledge into something you can see on screen. And Prehistoric Planet had that budget where you could do everything. Well, maybe not everything, but you could certainly do so much more. And so it meant that I was designing not only the pterosaurs for that, but things like ammonites as well. And that was really fun designing ammonites. And people say, what does this thing look like? And the fun thing about designing those is that in some respects, we had the amount of soft tissue data we have for ammonites, as I'm sure you know, is really small. It's not that we have nothing, but it's far more limited than it should be, given the millions of ammonite fossils there are. So we had some guidance on what to do with the soft tissues, but also quite a lot of creative freedom. Doing the designs for that and trying to think about things in a very functional, practical way. And some of the, you know, some of the heteromorph ammonites, the things that have uncoiled themselves and turned themselves into long, straight sort of horn-shaped ammonites, or the things which are spiraling round and they look a bit like the U-bend under your toilet. And it's like, what on earth is that animal going to look like? So we had quite a lot of fun with that, but we also had guidance from ammonite experts, and we came up with some pretty crazy stuff. So that was a lot of fun. It's quite different from the work I would do with a pterosaur, which is far more, okay, here's the fossils. Any missing bits, you can do calculations to say, okay, so these missing bones should be X long. And once you've got a skeleton, you kind of have that standard tetrapod muscle plan you can put over everything. With ammonites, it was a lot more, I wouldn't say freeform exactly, because it was still science led. But we had more ability to say, okay, what's going to make sense for something like this? Because we can't just take the same ammonite and put it into every single shell. We have to think outside the box of some of these things, because it's just not going to work in some of these really weirdly shaped ones. That standard ammonite is just going to, it wouldn't function as an animal.
Yeah, I remember seeing the strange spirally shaped ammonites for the first time at a museum in Japan, and wondering to myself how they could possibly move through the water current in a way that made sense. One of the theories that I've heard recently from someone who is not an ammonite researcher, so I could be off base, but was that perhaps the shapes were not intended in some of those instances to be free swimming, but to somehow allow them to stay at the bottom of the ocean shelf, not necessarily all the way at the ocean floor, but the shallow sea, which I thought was an interesting theory. And I'd love to see more of the functional morphology behind ammonite research. But as you say, with invertebrates, it's a completely different game. For the hundreds, thousands of trilobite specimens we have, there's probably only about a dozen where we have soft tissue examples. And because animals like arthropods and mollusks, the two groups that trilobites and ammonites belong to respectively, have such variety in anatomy, it's really kind of it's a lot of creative license. And I've seen a lot of really interesting depictions coming out of that in terms of movement, but also color scheme, the way that people imagine these animals kind of moving around. When it comes to the motion of different animals, is that something that is of particular interest to you, or are there other aspects of the behavior and anatomy that you find more compelling when you're trying to depict them in these kind of video productions as opposed to the still images?
So, I think all these things go together. It's very difficult to talk about behavior without understanding motion, because someone might say that an animal can do something. It's like, okay, but how does it do that? Sometimes you get a phone call from a TV producer and they say, we're going to have our animal doing this. And your response will be, well, how? Like, how is it meant to do that? And if you ever watched a dinosaur documentary and something really weird has happened, and it looks awkward and hasn't landed with you as something that's believable, it's probably because someone made a decision somewhere down the line that this had to happen in the episode, and it was then just pushed through, and then some poor animator has to make it look right. And in some cases, you just can't make it look right, because it's not what the animal was doing. So yeah, you really have to take an integrated approach to understand, okay, this is how this animal walked and ran or flew or swam. Mm-hmm. This is how fast it could go. These are the complications it's going to encounter if you try and make it do this. This is how strong it was. This is the kind of things it can lift up. This is the sort of foliage it's able to eat. You have to be able to understand all of that. And only when you have that can you start building the stories and the ideas of what these animals are meant to do. And that's when you can then start looking, or that's when you should start looking at animating it, once you have a realistic understanding of the integrated whole of the functional morphology of the animal.
But I'm curious to know how you feel about these depictions of dinosaurs and other prehistoric animals that are less focused on realism and more focused on audience reactions, or audiences that I guess are expecting that from your work and feel, I guess, a bit disappointed or confused when they don't see that sort of meat-eating monster depiction presented to them.
So this is something that was really at the focus of King Tyrant, writing a book about T-Rex and wanting to emphasize the scientific aspect of it, because my take on this is that the scientifically informed versions of these animals are way more interesting than the versions you see on the big screen, and in part that's because the versions we see in cinema, they've got a job to do as antagonists of people. They have roles to fill in a narrative, and they're not allowed to be themselves, if you know what I mean. And so divorcing the sort of the mythology we have around some animals, particularly something like Tyrannosaurus, from the science is something that I enjoy doing in my work, because I feel that teasing out the real animal is it gives you a more interesting view of the past than it does if you just rely on the cliches and the stereotypes. As a science communicator, it also brings up issues where there are things that we want to talk to people about that, you know, that are new things that are really fun and exciting. What you find yourself having to do with popular animals like T-Rex or like pterosaurs is that anytime you want to go and talk to the public, you will have to dismantle the version they know from Jurassic Park or from Jurassic World. You have to say, all of that stuff, that probably isn't true. And so you're not actually telling people anything new. You're mm-hmm. telling them that what they thought they knew was incorrect. And then you can start telling them about new stuff. So the hyped up, popular version of these animals. On the one hand, they're very useful because they give people a foothold in the science, and it's great that we can actually say, okay, so you at least know what a pterosaur is, so that gives us a starting point, and they get people interested in science, so in that respect they're great ambassadors for science and for paleontology. On the other hand, it would be nice if we could have some more realistic scientific portrayals that aren't just and even within that, there are lots of documentaries that still rely on a lot of the same cliches and stereotypes that don't show the latest science on these animals, or they don't show any different science. So we are always having to talk about the same things over and over. And it would be nice as someone who's interested in education and in science communication. I would really like it if we could move the conversation on beyond some of these most basic points. But we do have, with things like, you've already mentioned Jurassic World, those guys just seem really adamant about sticking to a certain appearance and a certain mm-hmm. behavior for their dinosaurs. And it would be nice if we could move things on a little bit. And I don't say that in any way of disrespecting anyone who enjoys these films. If you enjoy them, that's great. But I'm thinking about them, from a educator's perspective and from someone who's interested in these animals, not just as film creatures. So, just to put that out there, because I know lots of people do get a lot of enjoyment out of these films, and that's why they keep making them.
Right, exactly. I mean, I would say that I enjoy, for example, Super Sentai and Tokusatsu shows. But when I look at that depiction of, say, this is Power Rangers, by the way. So if you are interested in Power Rangers and you are interested in those robotic versions of dinosaurs, I would say that you're interested in something that is not exactly in any way tied to the real animal. You can still enjoy both. It's completely valid as long as you don't get the two confused. And I think I would broadly agree with you. I guess what you're kind of saying is that having a positive approach to the way that we give people new information, maybe by telling them that some of these previous facts and information are wrong, but that they're... I guess rewarding that kind of inherent curiosity that they might have about the animal, as opposed to kind of engaging in some of these online arguments that tend to go for absolute ages over theropods.
Yeah, I mean, I learned the hard way. I think sometimes you just got to let those arguments play out, and it's amazing how much people will retread the same old ground. And sometimes you see people discussing things and getting quite heated over things which we actually have no idea about. And they're talking about behavior of animals or the intelligence of extinct animals. And it's things that we have so little information on. So you really can't have a firm opinion. I mean, you can certainly have a firm belief in how smart a dinosaur was or something like that. But in terms of what we actually can know and what's testable about these ideas is very, very little. And again, this is where I think, in some cases that it's a shame that sometimes science communication is somewhat hampered by the having to dismantle the hype around animals, around certain animals, because that's the kind of thing that it would be great to be talking to people more about. The challenge is when you have to spend 20 minutes of your talk saying about what isn't true, you then only have a few minutes at the end to say, so here's what we actually know. And so the new information just doesn't trickle down with the same force as the other thing. And of course, the other challenge we have is that the entertainment versions of dinosaurs, they just have so much greater reach than we do. How many millions of people are going to go see Jurassic Park 7, which I guess we're into now? There's going to be millions of people going to see that. How many people go to a talk by actual paleontologists? So you can communicate all of the really cool science about things, but how many people does it actually reach?
It's also a case. Go ahead.
I was going to say, of course, and you do have people who are just sort of genuine fans of those franchises, and the problem is that as you mentioned, we have things like Jurassic Park, Jurassic World are inspired by paleontology, but they're not really showing paleontology. That distinction is not really apparent to many fans of that franchise. They think they're just showing dinosaurs, and it's like, well, they're not really dinosaurs. They're not dinosaurs, we understand them. And it's all these kind of subtleties and nuances that get lost, and people are just like, look, that's what a dinosaur is. It's a big shouty, roary thing. It's like, well, that's your version of what that dinosaur is, but our version over here as scientists is very different.
Right. It behaves like an actual animal. some of which occasionally do roar and shout, but they're usually engaged in other behaviors. The comment I was going to make is that it's also a case of funding, I suppose, because you see a lot of people that are willing to pay a certain amount for a ticket price or a Blu-ray DVD for these different franchises, but how many of those people are also donating to research that gets conducted on these animals, the kind of digs that, for those of you who don't know, digs are expensive and we don't always get them covered by public institutions. So it is a case of how much funding do we actually get in paleontology.
That was absolutely fascinating. That was part one of the interview. We're going to have part two in a future episode, but you have donned something exciting.
That's right, listeners. If you are not watching the video version of this, you are missing out on seeing me in the ridiculously Melbourne hipstery version of our Fossils in Fiction beanie. It is a gorgeous goldenrod yellow and it features my boy, Skitters. I've also got this lovely mug. It is also yellow and it says Fossils in Fiction and features both of our lovely mascots, Scratch and Skitters. These are both available at our online store. My mom actually got these for me though. So shout out to my mom. Love you, mom. Well, today we have another little special segment for you guys. We're going to be challenging each other to a game of spelling involving prehistoric animal names.
This is going to be a challenge for me because I said to Alyssa, let's do a prehistoric spelling bee. And I immediately said to her, I have one for you and it is diabolical. And so what I have done there is set myself an impossible challenge where I have no doubt that Alyssa has gone out and found something. If I've said it's diabolical for her, she's going to find something super diabolical for me.
Faith in you. You went to college. You'll be fine.
This is inspired by, for those outside Australia and New Zealand, obviously spelling bees are great, but one of the funniest television shows on air in Australia and New Zealand at the moment is Guy Mont Spelling Bee, hosted by Guy Montgomery, and they get comedians to go on and spell. And actually, it's so funny. Like, it sounds really boring, but I was watching this and I'm like, okay, we have to do this. Right. Hit me with it. Hit me with your first spelling bee. Name.
Okay, so I'm going to introduce the animal and then I'm going to say its name for you, just so our listeners have a little bit of fun with it as well. I'm going to start you off easy, you know? We get three each was the rules, right?
Yep.
Okay, so this first animal is an extinct family of terrestrial carnivores that belong to the suborder Caniformia. So this is an order that includes quite a few different modern carnivorous animals, not necessarily like all true carnivores. These animals first appeared in North America during the Middle Eocene, but they've spread to many other continents during their long span on this planet. They are largely referred to in colloquial literature as bear dogs. I am obsessed with them. They are probably more closely related to modern cats than they are bears or dogs, but that is why scientifically we refer to them as Amphicyonidae. That is the family Amphicyonidae.
Amphicyonidae. Okay. I know Amphicyon maybe is a species of that, I think, Amphicyon. Bear dogs. Amphicyonidae. Okay. I'm going to go for A-M-P-H-A-C-I-O.
You were so close, so close. It is Amphicyonidae. Amphicyonidae.
Okay. Yeah, right. First species for you is, and I will likewise read about the species. This comes from Wikipedia, and then I'm going to ask for the spelling. So the species is Enquebosaurus, a basal celurosaur, and the basalmost member of the celurosaurian clade Ornithomimosauria from the early Cretaceous of South Africa. The name Enquebosaurus is derived from the Xhosa word Enqueba, which is the local name for the Kirkwood district in ancient Xhosa, and it means in part fast runner, which is the species name, but I'm not asking for that one. Currently, it is the oldest celurosaur in Africa and shows that basal celurosaurian dinosaurs inhabited Gondwana 50 million years earlier than previously thought. Your word is Enquebosaurus.
You were right. That's diabolical. Jeez. Okay. I mean, like, first of all, props to them for choosing, like, a more local word and not just for the millionth time naming it after some old dead white guy. Like, shout out to the people of South Africa for choosing a better way. I'm stalling. Okay. I feel based on the vibe that this is one of the times where they're going to be very generous to white speakers and use a U after the Q. So I'm going to guess E-N-Q.
They were not generous to English speakers.
Ugh.
It is N-Q.
Wow.
Yeah. I was actually looking for one. I thought there was a dinosaur that was like, it begins with a silent M. And that's what I was looking for when I found Enquebosaurus. Oh. But... So there you go. We are being pretty diabolical to each other today.
It's Travis here, just jumping in during the edit to say that I think the dinosaur I was thinking of here is actually a fake dinosaur from Friends.
Well, if it's like the Lake Bosco in Congo, then MB.
Anyway, back to the spelling bee.
Well, my next one, you might actually already know this guy. He's a pretty popular dinosaur. It's a genus, actually, of extinct. I'm also using Wikipedia, by the way, listeners at home. We're cribbing Wikipedia today. This is a genus of extinct ceratopsian dinosaur from the early Cretaceous of Asia. It's most notable for being an animal we have absolutely tons of examples of, to the point where we do get some preserved examples of skin. And in particular, it's most well known for being one of the best and one of the only examples in the dinosaur kingdom of an animal whose cloaca has been preserved. And we also know what color the cloaca was, which is an additional horrible fact that I had to learn. So now it's your turn. This animal is called Cetacosaurus.
I know Cetacosaurus. I can picture the word in my head. The problem is not going to come for me where you were hoping it's going to be. It's in the middle. So Cetacosaurus. P-S-I-double-T-A-C. This is the bit I wasn't sure about, whether it's a double C-A or... Okay, so I've got to the C. I'm now going to say A-S-A-U-R-U-S.
So close. It was an O.
It is an O. And not double C. So it's just one letter wrong. Is that right?
Yeah, that's one letter. But you were really close. That's pretty good.
Okay. But it wasn't the silent P that did me in on that one.
No, you did very well. Well done on Cetacosaurus.
Thank you. Okay. This one I am going to give a genus and species name.
Okay.
But they're not particularly long. It is Teleosaurus aposoma. Now, Teleosaurus aposoma was mentioned in a recent episode. It is from, the reason I've picked this one, it is from your part of the world in Appalachia. So Teleosaurus aposoma is an extinct genus of rhinoceratid. It lived in North America during the Miocene and Pliocene epochs from around 17.4.9 million years ago. It grew up to lengths of 13 feet, 4 meters long. Teleosaurus went extinct in North America alongside Aphelops at the end of the Hemphillian period, most likely due to rapid climate cooling, increased seasonality, and expansion of seafloor grasses. The Gray fossil site in northern Tennessee, dated to 4.5 to 5 million years ago, hosts one of the last known populations of Teleosaurus, which is Teleosaurus aposoma.
Okay, so I'm writing it down so I can see how it looks. Is that allowed?
Yeah.
Okay.
No, go for it.
Teleosaurus aposoma. Yeah. Okay. Because there's a...
Aposoma. There's a couple ways... Gray fossil site in Tennessee.
Yeah, and so, like, for the listeners at home who may have missed the Gray Fossil Site episode as well, so the rhinoceros and other megafauna that existed in America was, like, it was a special obsession of some of our founding fathers. Thomas Jefferson notoriously was, like, determined to find the North American lion and the North American whatever rhinoceroses, and that was actually one of his, like, pet projects for the Lewis and Clark expedition, was finding
all the presumption was that they were still alive somewhere in the interior, wasn't it? Yeah.
Well, he's like, we've got all these, you know, skulls and stuff we're finding, they gotta still be here. So okay, I'm gonna guess that Telly is a name. I'm gonna guess that it's Teleyocerus, and I'm gonna guess that
Apocema is A double P.
That is incorrect. Teleoceros. Teleoceras. I think you put US on the end there.
Yep.
And Apocema is AEPYSOMA.
EP, goodness. It's the Appalachians. Y'all.
Yes, Greek. So teleoceros comes from the Greek for perfect or mimic. Tele, like television, the same root word there. And horn or keratus for teleoceros. Apocema, I'm not too sure where that one comes from, but that's the origin of teleoceros anyway. So
that's super
fair. There we go.
Well, as you guys can tell, I did not do well in my spelling bees as a kid. Google, the Google and Clippy, the underlines with the red are my friends, but I think it's a one-way friendship. I think both of those features are sick of my shit.
Fair.
Okay, this is my last one for you. This one has been on my mind recently because I just finished tutoring a unit 2231. I found out some of my students are listeners of the podcast, so shout out to the 2231 students. Most of you were struggling with the spelling of this animal's name as well, so I think it's a fair challenge. But this animal is an incredibly important animal to understanding the evolution of the vertebrate clade. It might be synonymous with an animal called Hycuichthys, which recently appeared in a publication that included author Neil Shubin about the possible origins for bone material in the Cambrian, which I dislike not because the research is inaccurate, but because I want them to keep their filthy bones out of my time period. But so this is a basal chordate, a genus of basal chordate from the Lower Cambrian Mao Tianshen shales of China. Those tones are all in the wrong place. Sorry to my Mandarin friends. This is a 418 million year old basal chordate who is thought to be a stem or ancestral vertebrate, although it is really difficult to tell from the fossils we have whether or not the skeletal elements are actually skeletal, if they're cartilaginous, or if it's some kind of precursor to either system. So it's an incredibly important animal, a little fish-shaped creature, and it is called Mylocunmingia. I'm not going to give you the genus name or the species name unless you would just really like the genus and species, but the genus is Mylocunmingia. Mylocunmingia.
Right.
It's a Mandarin in there. You were going to
give me Tiktaalik for a minute, and I was like, oh, you know, I can get Tiktaalik. That works. But yeah, okay. Mylocunmingia. So I'm assuming that is from the Kunming province of China. That doesn't mean I can spell it accurately. Well, I'm going to say just M-I-L-O-K-U-N Kunming. M-I-N-G.
You're really, really close. I too wish it was Milo, like the sports drink. But Milo in this case is referring to the segments that appear in some vertebrates, which are myomeres. And if you Latinize that in order to go into a genus name that is unique, you would spell it M-Y.
Of course. Fair enough. Well, what we originally did, because obviously we hadn't shared these options with each other, is we prepared four, but we were only going to guess three. And I'm sitting here looking at my last two, and I'm going to give you a choice.
Okay.
So the first one is an Australian dinosaur. All I'm saying. It's an Australian dinosaur. The second option is a trilobite. You are a trilobite expert. So do you go for the trilobite and potentially embarrass yourself if you can't spell something that you are about to get a PhD in? Or do you go for the Australian dinosaur?
The Australians are already ashamed of me. Let's go Australia.
Okay. Now, there's a risk if I can even pronounce this one correctly, because every time I say it, I get it wrong. I want to say it a different way, but I'm going to try really hard. It's quite a famous Australian dinosaur. It's not the one that's on our logo.
Okay.
Just to be clear. It's not that one.
Because that's too easy.
Yeah. This is Lialan.
No.
Lialanosaura, meaning Lialan's lizard. It's a genus of small herbivorous ornithischian dinosaur from the late Aptian to the early Albian stage of the early Cretaceous around 118 to 110 million years ago, discovered in Dinosaur Cove, Victoria, Australia. The only known species is Lialanosaura emicographica. It was described in 1989 and named after Lialan Rich, the daughter of Australian paleontologist couple Tom Rich and Patricia Vickers Rich, who discovered it. The specific name Emica Graphica translate to friend writing and honours both the Friends of the Museum of Victoria and the National Geographic Society for their support of Australian paleontology. Your word is Lialanosaura.
So two things about this. For those of you who remember, I've been on a Women in Paleo panel with Pat. I know Pat recently.
I was aware of this when I picked it.
The second thing is that I regularly want to say Lialanosuchus or Lialanosuchus, and I get roasted by my lab mates for one, not knowing how to say it, and notoriously being unable to spell it. I was hoping for Wewarosaurus or Muttabuttosaurus. Thank you, Pat Rich. Thank you for naming your daughter such a fun word. I'm gonna guess the way that I know is not wrong, because the way I want to spell it is definitely wrong, but I'm gonna guess.
Do you want a hint?
Yes.
I think you'll get the first letter. That's fine, right? Just after that, there are three vowels in a row.
Oh, right. Okay. Okay. Okay.
See if that helps.
Okay. I'm gonna guess L E A E L L Y N O S A U R U S.
Oh. Here's a trick for beginners. Sora, not Saurus.
You can tell I don't. You're going to take my degree because away, Sora, Travis.
Sora is the feminine version of Saurus, which is the typical way that dinosaurs are named. But Sora is when you name a dinosaur after a woman, then you tend, or after a feminine pronoun, then you tend to use Sora. That's my understanding of that anyway. You got the first part quite right. L-E-A-E-L-L-Y-N. I think you then said O instead of A.
Yep.
And so it's N-A-S-A-U-R-A.
You're never going to let me back on the dig.
I thought you had it. I really thought you had it.
See, I have no problem with the Welsh.
The Welsh was fine. And, you know, I've no doubt that every time I've pronounced it, I've actually been incorrect with the pronunciation, but you knew what I was talking about, so that's not a problem.
Well, I want to spell it the Southern way, which would be like you would use significantly fewer vowels and consonants, and you would get roughly the same noise. But every time I try and Google it, Google is upset with me. So clearly, it's not the first part of the word that I'm messing up.
Well, thank you for that. That has been fun. I think we need to come back and do that again at some point. I would love to see a live panel version of Can You Spell This Dinosaur?
Absolutely.
That would be fantastic. Thank you so much for your interview with Mark as well. That was really fantastic. I'm looking forward to part two. Of course, I've edited the interview, so I know all along what's coming, and there's some really exciting stuff. And we can also promise, we have been saying this for a while now, but we have some amazing interviews coming, and we can say this because they have now been recorded.
Yes.
By the time you're hearing this, they have been recorded and they are coming. So look out for our episodes over the next few months. Jump on to our website, fossilsandfiction.co, to support us or buy some merch and rep Skitters in that wonderful beanie.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And if you guys have any comments or questions, if you wish to type the clown emoji repeatedly in the chat with me tagged, that is also an acceptable form of engagement with the clowning we've done in this episode.
Clowns who cannot spell. That's us.
Honk, honk. Thanks for joining us for this episode of Fossils in Fiction. If you enjoyed the show, be sure to rate, review, and follow us on your favorite podcast platform.
And don't forget to connect with us on social media. Share your fossil-inspired stories, art, or questions. We'd love to feature you in an upcoming episode. Until next time, keep exploring the culture and science of paleontology.